But first, a story about a war. An explosion rips apart a U.S. Navy ship overseas. Sensationalist media demand retribution. Hawks in Washington argue for invasion, insisting that our soldiers will be greeted as liberators. The war goes well at first, but we end up occupying a country halfway around the world, where a stubborn insurgency takes root, and where our troops start waterboarding prisoners. Well, all that happened over a century ago. It was the Spanish-American War. And Evan Thomas says the familiarity is no coincidence. His new book is called The War Lovers, and I am very pleased to welcome Evan Thomas back to Studio 360. Hi.
Hi, Kurt.
So the Spanish-American War, like the Mexican War 50 years earlier, vies for being the most forgotten war in American history. You bring it to life beautifully. I didn't even know why it was fought, really, until I read your book. Why did you want to write about it now?
I started thinking about it in 2006 when I was writing about the Iraq War for Newsweek. I had been a hawk on the Iraq War for the invasion of Iraq, and I was—
Full hawk?
No, I would say I was kind of a whingy 5149 journalist hawk. But I was starting to think about the idea of war fever, how we get swept up into— how nations get swept up into wars. And I didn't really want to write about Iraq. A lot of people were already doing that. But I went looking for another war, and I found one a century earlier, different from the Iraq War, but had some of the same qualities. And it certainly was a story about a nation getting swept up into desire to fight a war that was a war of choice. We certainly did not have to fight it. It did some good. You know, it liberated Cuba and was not necessarily a bad— – in fact, one diplomat called it a splendid little war.
No, the mission accomplished after a few months.
Right.
Right away.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
And they thought they would throw flowers and greet us as liberators?
Exactly. And it sort of happened that way, a little bit kind of. But it actually turned sour because when we got there, we discovered that the people we were liberating, many of them were black. And this is sort of hard. You have to think back. This is 1890s. Jim Crow is just passing the South. They're just taking over the South.
Well, and Northerners, Teddy Roosevelt, one of your main characters, has an absolute outright respectable view that there are inferior and superior races, and guess which was which?
Well, the most respectable people of all, the bastion of racial superiority, Harvard.
Several of your main characters are Harvard boys and men. Give a sketch, thumbnails, of each of your main guys.
Well, Theodore Roosevelt almost needs no introduction. I mean, he was just determined to get himself into a war. He wrote these wonderful letters about— any war would have done. Germany, that would have been fine. Invade Canada, that was good. Invade Mexico.
Or have a war with Britain, which I never knew about until I read your book, that just a few years before they had their war over Cuba with Spain, there was a serious, albeit brief, desire to go to war with England over Venezuela.
Over Venezuela. This is completely nutty. But it shows you how desirous we were for war, that we were even entertaining the idea of taking on the British
Navy. There's Teddy Roosevelt, young Teddy Roosevelt.
Young Teddy. His best friend, Henry Cabot Lodge, who was really our first great imperialist. He was the first one to come up with a theory about sea power. All great nations are great sea powers. And so the third hawk in my group of five was William Randolph Hearst, who was just a wonderful character. Hearst went to war. He called it his war, the Journal's War. He claimed to have started it. He was a newspaper publisher who understood that you could sell newspapers by selling war. And he went to this war with about a score of correspondents, 12 yachts, a hot air balloon, the first ever motion picture camera for taking a war.
Did he really say or send the telegram, you furnish the pictures and I'll furnish the war?
He denied it. It shows up in a memoir of one of his editors. I have no idea what the truth was, but it certainly expressed, in all other evidence shows, it expressed his desire to start a war and call it his war. In fact, he would call it the Journal's War.
And Orson Welles certainly. Remember that scene in Citizen Kane where the Hearst figure gets the telegram from his man in Havana?
That part of the movie was right.
Read the cable.
Girls, delightful in Cuba, stop.
Could send you prose poems about scenery, but don't feel right spending your money. Stop. There is no war in Cuba. Signed, Wheeler. Any answer?
Yes, dear Wheeler, you provide the prose poems. I'll provide the war.
That's fine, Mr. Kane.
Yes, I rather like myself. Send it right away.
Charles Foster Kane or William Randolph Hearst in real life character. So those were the three hawks and your two doves.
My two doves were William James, a philosopher who really understood the pull of war, the seduction of war, And he understood why young men wanted to go to war, but he warned against it, that it was a false god. He was Teddy Roosevelt's teacher at Harvard. Roosevelt didn't pay such close attention to him at the time. But all these people know each other. And the last character, and in some ways the least known but most intriguing to me, is a fellow named Thomas Brackett Reed, who was the Speaker of the House, known as Czar Reed, a very powerful figure. And he has the common sense to see that this war is nuts. Why are we doing this? He is very close friends with Roosevelt and Lodge, but he splits with them over this. He's the dove. He's, why are we doing this?
He wanted to be president. Maybe he could have been president.
And certainly everybody thought he was the smartest guy around and a very powerful guy. But the book ends with him in disgrace and sort of dying of a broken heart.
Well, and this is 30-odd years after the Civil War, so most of your principals, certainly Teddy Roosevelt, their missing of the Civil War service loomed over them.
One of the subplots, and this will be familiar to people who've looked at Iraq, is older men who didn't go to war, who missed the experience, kind of missed out on the experience, wanting to have it. And interestingly, the hawks are all people in my book who have not been to war. The dove is the president of the United States. William McKinley is against the war. Why? He's been to Antietam. He was in the Civil War. He saw, as he put it, the bodies stacked up at Antietam. He's in no rush to go to war, but he gets rolled by Roosevelt and Hearst and all these, you know, war lovers.
So it was a John Kerry, Dick Cheney beta version.
Beta version, yeah. I mean, you could stretch these analogies, but there's something to it. There's no question that the president just got overwhelmed.
As you're thinking about the Iraq War, as you're writing this book and all the inescapable parallels, what did you think about the press role in this war that we're still fighting?
I think we got caught up in it, and I think I did. I remember so vividly in the winter of 2003 how excited the press got, including the editors at Newsweek, including me. Journalists love conflict, right? What's the biggest conflict? War. People really bridle at this. I mean, I've gotten into a lot of arguments about this, but I felt deep down there was a almost primal desire to have a war for a lot of reasons. Part of it, I think, and this motivated President Bush, after 9/11, we wanted to be crude about this, kick some ass.
And not unlike the Spanish-American War, it hasn't seemed to have sent us over to the other side the way Vietnam did, to, this was a huge mistake, let's never do this again, the way we did in 1975.
It hasn't worked out that badly either. I mean, there is a sort of kind of democracy in Iraq. I think along about 2006, people were thinking, oh, my God, this is Vietnam. And something else happened, I think, that's important. I think I felt ashamed of the way we treated the military in Vietnam. But this idea of spitting on soldiers, now, it's been exaggerated how much that happened. I don't think it really happened that much. But it is true that soldiers coming home from Vietnam would take off their uniforms in the bathroom and put on their civvies. Today, I think we are compensating for that somewhat by being appropriately respectful of soldiers who have sacrificed a lot and are coming home.
Although that respect is tested, what did you make of the recent video that surfaced showing this American Apache helicopter killing a group of Iraqis in Baghdad? The tape almost looks like a video game, and you can hear the soldiers' radio transmissions about the action. Let's listen to this abridged, condensed version of the audio.
Request permission to engage.
I'm picking up the wounded. Yeah, we're trying to get permission to engage. Come on, let us shoot.
Bushmaster 7, roger. This is Bushmaster 7, roger, engage.
1-8, engage. Clear.
Come on.
Clear. Clear. We're engaged.
Oh, yeah, look at those dead bastards.
Nice. 2-6, Crazy Horse 1-8.
Oh, yeah, look at that, right through the windshield.
Now, as it turned out, two of the people who were killed in that action were Reuters journalists. And stuff like that happens in war, but certainly the very sound of that, the chuckling and everything, and the fact that the video version looks like a video game makes you wonder about the lines between kind of make-believe in the pop culture and real war fighting.
Well, you know, I've always wanted to write a story about these guys out in Colorado who, you know, live in a nice suburb, get up in the morning, send their kids to school, drive into work, and then pilot these drones and kill some people.
The
and
predators the over,
predator
over
drones,
in
you know, and,
Afghanistan and Pakistan.
And they do it all through, you know, thousands of miles away. And then they could pick up their kids from soccer practice and go home and have dinner and, you know, kiss their wife goodnight. What an eerie, disconnected existence. There is a human instinct against killing. There, it's well shown. In fact, there are these studies in World War II that show that most soldiers did not fire their rifles. They really had to be trained to do it. But of course, when you're in the thick of things and people are shooting you, you're gonna shoot back, and you have to steel yourself to do it. You have to dehumanize your enemies. You have to treat them as animals in order to be able to do it. So I feel sorry for those guys caught in that tape. I mean, I'm not sure I would have been any different with my adrenaline running like crazy and trying to get myself psyched up to do it. I mean, it's, you know, wars are debasing things.
Evan Thomas, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kurt.
Evan Thomas's new book is called The War Lovers, Roosevelt, Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire, 1898.